Chapter 13. Investigating Social Dynamics. De-individuation, Dehumanization, and the Evil of Inaction. Before the Holocaust. His views reflect a basic theme in Western literature that mankind has suffered a great fall from its original state of perfection, starting with Adam's act of disobedience against God when he succumbed to Satan's temptation. The social philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau elaborated this theme of the corrupting influence of social forces by envisioning human beings as noble primitive savages whose virtues were diminished by contact with corrupting society. In stark opposition to this conception of human beings as the innocent victims of an all-powerful, malignant society is the view that people are born evil, genetic bad seeds. Our species is driven by wanton desires, unlimited appetites, and hostile impulses unless people are transformed into rational, reasonable, compassionate human beings by education, religion, and family, or controlled by the discipline imposed upon them by the authority of the state. Where do you stand in this ages-old debate? Are we born good and then corrupted by an evil society, or born evil and redeemed by a good society? Before casting your ballot, consider an alternative perspective. Maybe each of us has the capacity to be a saint or a sinner, altruistic or selfish, gentle or cruel, dominant or submissive, perpetrator or victim, prisoner or guard. Maybe it is our social circumstances that determine which of our many mental templates, our potentials, we develop. Scientists are discovering that embryonic stem cells are capable of becoming virtually any kind of cell or tissue, and ordinary skin cells can be turned into embryonic stem cells. It is tempting to expand these biological concepts and what is now known about the developmental plasticity of the human brain to the plasticity of human nature. What we are is shaped both by the broad systems that govern our lives, wealth and poverty, geography and climate, historical epoch, cultural, political, and religious dominance, and by the specific situations we deal with daily. Those forces, in turn, interact with our basic biology and personality. I have argued earlier that the potential for perversion is inherent in the complexity of the human mind. The impulse toward evil and the impulse toward good together comprise the most fundamental duality in human nature. This conception offers a complex, richer portrait of the pride and puzzles in human actions. We have examined the power of group conformity and obedience to authority that can dominate and subvert individual initiative. Next, we add insights from research into the domains of de-individuation, dehumanization, and bystander apathy, or the evil of inaction. This information will complete the foundation for us to fully appreciate how ordinary good individuals, perhaps even you, gentle reader, can be led at times to do bad things to others, even bad deeds that violate any sense of common decency or morality. De-individuation, Anonymity and Destructiveness. William Golding's novel Lord of the Flies asks how a simple change in one's external appearance can trigger dramatic changes in overt behavior. Good British choir boys are transformed into murderous little beasts by simply painting their faces. When food runs out on their desert island, a group of boys, led by Jack Meridew, try to kill a pig, but they can't complete the act because killing has been inhibited by their Christian morality. Then Jack decides to paint his face into a mask, and as he does, a frightening metamorphosis occurs as he sees his reflection in the water. He looked in astonishment, no longer at himself, but at an awesome stranger. He spilt the water and leapt to his feet, laughing excitedly. Beside the pool, his sinewy body held up a mask that drew their eyes and appalled them, the other boys. He began to dance, and his laughter became a bloodthirsty snarling. He capered toward Bill, and the mask was a thing on its own, behind which Jack hid, liberated from shame and self-consciousness. After the other boys in Jack's gang also disguise themselves with painted masks, they are readily able to kill the pig, cut her throat, spill her blood. Once that alien deed of killing another creature is accomplished, they then relish the fun of killing both animals and their human enemies, notably the intellectual boy nicknamed Piggy. Might makes right, and all hell breaks loose as Ralph, the good boy leader, is hunted down by the herd. Is there any psychological validity to the notion that disguising one's external appearance can drastically infect behavioral processes? I attempted to answer that question with a set of studies that helped stimulate a new field of inquiry on the psychology of de-individuation and antisocial behavior. The shocking behavior of anonymous women. The basic procedure in this first experiment involved having female college students believe they were delivering a series of painful electric shocks to other women under the guise of a believable cover story. They would have multiple opportunities to shock each of two other young women whom they saw and heard from behind a one-way mirror. Half of the student volunteers were randomly assigned to a condition of anonymity or de-individuation, half to a condition where their identity was made salient, or individuation. The four college student subjects, in each of the 10 separately tested de-individuation groups, had their appearance concealed by hoods and loose, oversized lab coats, their names replaced by numbers, 1 to 4. The experimenter treated them as an anonymous group, not as individuals. These procedures were performed allegedly to mask their nonverbal behavior so that others could not detect their reactions. The comparison group, by contrast, was given name tags that helped to make them feel unique, but everything else was the same for them as for those in the de-individuated groups. Both the de-individuated and the comparison subjects were in 4-woman groups, and both were asked to repeatedly shock each of 2 women victims over the course of 20 trials. The cover story was that the target women were subjects in a study of creativity under stress. The job of our participants was to stress them by administering painful electric shocks while I, as the experimenter in the next room, also behind the mirror, administered the creativity test. Unlike in the Milgram paradigm, there was no authority directly pressuring them to act aggressively by delivering these painful shocks, because I did not interact with them at all during the shock episodes. The students could see me through the observation window, along with each of the 2 women in the alleged creativity study. In addition, there was no group conformity pressure exerted on them, because they did not interact with one another, being in separate cubicles adjacent to one another. Finally, there was not even pressure on them to perform the task in order not to violate the rationale for the study. If any one of the 4 group members delivered a shock, the target woman would act hurt, so there would be sufficient stress induced to impact her creativity. Thus, not shocking would be neither disobedient nor confrontational. One could be merely a passive observer of teammate shocking instead of an active perpetrator. The behavior of interest was the duration of shock administered, how long each student continued to hold down the shock button after the shock ready signal appeared. Their decision was not whether to press the shock switch, but how quickly to pull their finger off the switch or to keep pressing it down and deliver longer shocks to the victims. Of course, they could choose not to follow the instructions and refuse to even press the shock switch at all. No one ever did that. One of the complicit women had been portrayed as very nice, the other as bitchy, in their tape-recorded interviews. This was done to create divergent attitudes toward them in the minds of their stress inducers. Actually, they were both research confederates, trained to act as though they were in pain when a shock light lit up, and to give a convincing performance that the students in the other room could witness. Before the experiment began, each of the students in the study was given a sample of the painful shock of 75 volts, so they knew that it would hurt, But of course no shock was actually given in the experiment. For each of 20 trials, the women had to decide whether and for how long they would administer this standard level of painful shock to a woman who was seemingly suffering in pain from their actions. Then, after the first target woman left, she was replaced by the second target woman for yet another round of 20 shock trials. Because each member of the four-person experimental and comparison groups was tested in adjacent individual cubicles, their teammates could not directly influence their behavior. Nevertheless, they had a sense of being in a group from having been together initially while they listened together to the tape recordings. It is important to note that, except for the manipulation of anonymity versus identifiability, everything in the study was identical for both groups. The results were clear. The women in the de-individuation condition delivered twice as much shock to both victims as did the comparison women who had been randomly assigned to the individuated condition. Moreover, the women who were anonymous shocked both victims equally, the one they had previously rated as pleasant and the other they had rated as unpleasant. It did not matter what they had previously felt about them once they had their finger on the trigger. They also increased shock time for both over the course of the 20 trials, holding their finger down ever longer on the shock switch as their victims twisted and moaned right before them. In contrast, the individuated women discriminated between the likable and unpleasant targets, shocking the pleasant woman less over time than they did the unpleasant one. That the anonymous women ignored their previous liking or disliking of the two target women when they had the chance to harm them speaks to a dramatic change in their mentality when in this psychological state of de-individuation. The escalation of shock, with repeated opportunities to administer its painful consequences, appears to be an upward spiraling effect of the emotional arousal that is being experienced. The agitated behavior becomes self-reinforcing, each action stimulating a stronger, less controlled next reaction. Experientially, it comes not from sadistic motives of wanting to harm others, but rather from the energizing sense of one's domination and control over others at that moment in time. This basic paradigm has been repeated with comparable results in a host of laboratory and field studies, using de-individuating masks, administering white noise, or throwing styrofoam balls at the target victims, and with military personnel from the Belgian Army, as well as with school children and a variety of college students. Similar escalations of shock over time were also found in a study where teacher shockers were supposed to be educating their pupil victims. They, too, delivered increasing levels of shock across training sessions. The Stanford Prison Experiment, as you recall, relied on the de-individuating silver-reflecting sunglasses for the guards and staff, along with standard military-style uniforms. One important conclusion flows from this body of research. Anything or any situation that makes people feel anonymous, as though no one knows who they are or cares to know, reduces their sense of personal accountability, thereby creating the potential for evil action. This becomes especially true when a second factor is added. If the situation or some agency gives them permission to engage in antisocial or violent action against others, as in these research settings, people are ready to go to war. If, instead, the situation conveys merely a reduction of self-centeredness with anonymity and encourages pro-social behavior, people are ready to make love. Anonymity in party settings often makes for more socially engaging parties. So William Golding's insight about anonymity and aggression was psychologically valid, but in more complex and interesting ways than he depicted. "Sure, this robe of mine doth change my disposition." William Shakespeare, The Winter's Tale. Anonymity can be conferred on others not only with masks, but also by the way that people are treated in given situations. When others treat you as if you are not a unique individual, but just an undifferentiated other being processed by the system, or your existence is ignored, you feel anonymous. The sense of a lack of personal identifiability can also induce antisocial behavior. When a researcher treated college student research volunteers either humanely or as guinea pigs in an experiment, guess who ripped him off when he wasn't looking? Later on, these students found themselves alone in the professor-researcher's office with the opportunity to steal coins and pens from a bowl full of them. Those who were in the anonymity condition stole much more often than did the humanely treated students. Kindness can be more than its own reward. Halloween aggression by school children. What happens when children go to an unusual Halloween party where they put on costumes and are given permission by their teacher to play aggressive games for prizes? Will anonymity plus opportunity to aggress lead children to engage in more aggression over time? Elementary school children attended a special experimental Halloween party given by their teacher and supervised by a social psychologist, Scott Fraser. There were many games to play, and the children could win tokens for each game they won. These tokens could be exchanged for gifts at the end of the party. The more tokens you won, the better the toys you could get, so the motivation to win as many tokens as possible was high. Half the games were non-aggressive in nature, and half involved confrontations between two children to reach the goal. For example, a non-aggressive game might have individual students trying to speedily retrieve a beanbag in a tube, while a potentially aggressive game would entail two students competing to be the first one to get that one beanbag out of the tube. The aggression observed typically involved the competitors pushing and shoving each other. It was not very extreme, but was characteristic of first-stage physical encounters between children. The experimental design used only one group, in which each child served as his or her own control. This procedure is known as the ABA format. Pre-baseline, change introduced, post-baseline. The children first played the games without costumes, A, then with costumes, B, then again without costumes, A. Initially, while the games were played, the teachers said the costumes were on the way, so they would start the fun while they waited for them to arrive. Then, when the costumes arrived, they were put on in different rooms, so the children's identities were not known to each other, and they played the same games, but now in costume. In the third phase, the costumes were removed, allegedly to be given to other children in other parties, and the games continued as in the first phase. Each phase of the games lasted about an hour. The data are striking testimony to the power of anonymity. Aggression among these young school children increased significantly as soon as they put the costumes on. The percentage of the total time that these children played the aggressive games more than doubled from their initial base level average, up from 42% in A to 86% in B. Equally interesting was the second major result. Aggression had a high negative payoff. The more time a child spent engaged in the aggressive games, the fewer tokens she or he won during that phase of the party. Being aggressive thus cost the children a loss of tokens. Acting in the aggressive games took more time than the non-aggressive games, and only one of two contestants could win. So, overall, being aggressive lost valued prizes. However, that did not matter when the children were costumed and anonymous. The smallest number of tokens won was during the second, anonymity B, phase, where aggression was highest. Only an average of 31 tokens were won, compared to 58 tokens in the A phase. A third important finding was that there was no carryover of aggressive behavior from the high level in the B phase to the last A phase level, which was comparable to the initial A phase. The percentage of aggressive acts dropped to 36%, and the number of tokens won soared to 79. Thus, we can conclude that the behavior change brought on by anonymity did not create a dispositional internal change, but only an outward response change. Change the situation, and behavior changes in lockstep fashion. The use of this ABA design also makes apparent that perceived anonymity was sufficient to dramatically alter behavior in each time frame. Anonymity facilitated aggression even though the consequences of that physical aggression were not in the child's best immediate interest of winning tokens exchangeable for fine prizes. Aggression became its own reward. Goals that were distant took a back seat to the fun and games of the present moment. We will see a similar phenomenon operating in some of the Abu Ghraib abuses. In a related field study, Halloween trick-or-treaters visiting local homes in their own costumes were more likely to steal goodies when they were anonymous than when identifiable. Friends of the researchers put out bowls filled with candies and others with coins, each of which was labeled "Take One." Going beyond that limit constituted a transgression, stealing. Some children arrived alone, others in groups of friends. In the anonymous condition, the homeowner made it evident that he or she could not tell who they were. With their identities concealed by their costumes, the majority of those in groups stole the candy and money, just as did those college students in the study where they were treated as guinea pigs. This was in contrast to the non-anonymous condition, wherein the adult host had first asked them to reveal their identity behind their masks. Among the more than 700 children studied in this natural situation, more transgressions were found when they were in anonymous groups, 57%, than when anonymous and alone, 21%. Fewer transgressions occurred when non-anonymous children were alone, 8%, than when they were in groups of other non-anonymous trick-or-treaters, 21%. Even when alone and identifiable, the temptation of easy money and delicious treats was too great for some children to pass up. However, adding the full anonymity dimension turned that singular temptation into an overwhelming passion for most children to take all the goodies they could. Cultural wisdom. How to make warriors kill in war, but not at home. Let's leave the laboratory and the games at children's parties to go back to the real world, where these issues of anonymity and violence may take on life and death significance. Specifically, let's look at the differences between societies that go to war without having young male warriors change their appearance, and those that always include ritual transformations of appearance by painting faces and bodies or masking the warriors, as in Lord of the Flies. Does a change in external appearance make a significant difference in how warring enemies are then treated? A cultural anthropologist, R.J. Watson, posed that question after reading my earlier work on de-individuation. His data source was the Human Relations Area files, where information on cultures around the world is archived in the form of reports of anthropologists, missionaries, psychologists, and others. Watson found two pieces of data on societies in which warriors did or did not change their appearance prior to going to war, and the extent to which they killed, tortured, or mutilated their victims, a decidedly deadly dependent variable, the ultimate in outcome measures. The results are striking confirmation of the prediction that anonymity promotes destructive behavior, when permission is also given to behave in aggressive ways that are ordinarily prohibited. War provides the institutionally approved permission to kill or wound one's adversaries. This investigator found that, of the 23 societies for which these two data sets were present, in 15 warriors changed their appearance. They were the societies that were the most destructive. Fully 80% of them, 12 of 15, brutalized their enemies. By contrast, in 7 of 8 of the societies in which the warriors did not change their appearance before going into battle, they did not engage in such destructive behavior. Another way to look at this data is that 90% of the time when victims of battle were killed, tortured, or mutilated, it was by warriors who had first changed their appearance and de-individuated themselves. Cultural wisdom dictates that a key ingredient in transforming ordinarily non-aggressive young men into warriors who can kill on command is first to change their external appearance. Most wars are about old men persuading young men to harm and kill other young men like themselves. For the young men, it becomes easier to do so if they first change their appearance, altering their usual external facade by putting on military uniforms or masks or painting their faces. With the anonymity thus provided in place, out go their usual internal compassion and concern for others. When the war is on, the culture then dictates that the warriors return to their peacetime status. This reverse transformation is readily accomplished by making the warriors remove their uniforms, take off their masks, wash away the paint, and return to their former personae and peaceful demeanor. In a sense, it is as though they were in a macabre social ritual, unknowingly using the ABA paradigm of Fraser's Halloween experiment. Peaceful when identifiable, murderous when anonymous, peaceful again when returned to the identifiable condition. Certain environments convey a sense of transient anonymity in those who live or behave in their midst without changing their physical appearance. To demonstrate the impact of the anonymity of place in facilitating urban vandalism, my research team did a simple field study. Recall from Chapter 1 that we abandoned cars on the streets near the uptown campus of New York University in the Bronx, New York, and near Stanford University's campus in Palo Alto, California. We photographed and videotaped acts of vandalism against these cars, which were clearly abandoned, license plates removed, hoods raised. In the anonymity of the Bronx setting, several dozen passers-by, on the street or in cars, stopped to vandalize the car within 48 hours. Most were reasonably well-dressed adults who stripped the car of any valuable items or simply destroyed it, all in the daytime. By contrast, over a week's time, not a single passerby engaged in any act of vandalism against the car abandoned in Palo Alto. This demonstration was the only empirical evidence cited in support of the broken windows theory of urban crime. Environmental conditions contribute to making some members of society feel that they are anonymous, that no one in the dominant community knows who they are, that no one recognizes their individuality and thus their humanity. When that happens, we contribute to their transformation into potential vandals and assassins. For full details of this research and broken windows theory, see our Lucifer Effect website. De-individuation transforms our Apollonian nature into a Dionysian nature. Let's assume that the good side of people is the rationality, order, coherence, and wisdom of Apollo, while the bad side is the chaos, disorganization, irrationality, and libidinous core of Dionysus. The Apollonian central trait is constraint and the inhibition of desire. It is pitted against the Dionysian trait of uninhibited release and lust. People can become evil when they are enmeshed in situations where the cognitive controls that usually guide their behavior in socially desirable and personally acceptable ways are blocked, suspended, or distorted. The suspension of cognitive control has multiple consequences, among them the suspension of conscience, self-awareness, sense of personal responsibility, obligation, commitment, liability, morality, guilt, shame, fear, and analysis of one's actions in cost-benefit calculations. The two general strategies for accomplishing this transformation are A. Reducing the cues of social accountability of the actor, no one knows who I am or cares to, and B. Reducing concern for self-evaluation by the actor. The first cuts out concern for social evaluation, for social approval, doing so by making the actor feel anonymous, the process of de-individuation. It is effective when one is functioning in an environment that conveys anonymity and diffuses personal responsibility. The second strategy stops self-monitoring and consistency monitoring by relying on tactics that alter one's state of consciousness. This is accomplished by means of taking alcohol or drugs, arousing strong emotions, engaging in hyper-intense actions, getting into an expanded present-time orientation where there is no concern for past or future, and projecting responsibility outward onto others rather than inward toward oneself. De-individuation creates a unique psychological state in which behavior comes under the control of immediate situational demands and biological hormonal urges. Action replaces thought. Seeking immediate pleasure dominates delaying gratification, and mindfully restrained decisions give way to mindless emotional responses. A state of arousal is often both a precursor to and a consequence of de-individuation. Its effects are amplified in novel or unstructured situations where typical response habits and character traits are nullified. One's vulnerability to social models and situational cues is heightened. Therefore, it becomes as easy to make love as to make war. It all depends on what the situation demands or elicits. In the extreme, there is no sense of right and wrong, no thoughts of culpability for illegal acts, or hell for immoral ones. With inner restraint suspended, behavior is totally under external situational control. Outer dominates inner. What is possible and available dominates what is right and just. The moral compass of individuals and groups has then lost its polarity. The transition from Apollonian to Dionysian mentalities can be swift and unexpected, making good people do bad things as they live temporarily in the expanded present moment without concerns for the future consequences of their actions. Usual constraints on cruelty and libidinal impulses melt away in the excesses of de-individuation. It is as if there were a short circuit in the brain, cutting off the frontal cortex's planning and decision-making functions, while the more primitive portions of the brain's limbic system, especially its emotion and aggression center in the amygdala, take over. The Mardi Gras Effect. Communal de-individuation as ecstasy. In ancient Greece, Dionysus was unique among the gods. He was seen as creating a new level of reality that challenged traditional assumptions and ways of living. He represented both a force for the liberation of the human spirit from its staid confinement in rational discourse and orderly planning, and a force of destruction. Lust without limits and personal pleasure without societal controls. Dionysus was the god of drunkenness, the god of insanity, the god of sexual frenzy and battle lust. Dionysus' dominion includes all states of being that entail the loss of self-awareness and rationality, the suspension of linear time, and the abandonment of the self to those urges in human nature that overthrow codes of behavior and public responsibility. Mardi Gras has its origins as a pagan pre-Christian ceremony now recognized by the Roman Catholic Church as occurring on the Tuesday, Fat Tuesday or Shrove Tuesday, just before Ash Wednesday. That holy day marks the start of the Christian liturgical season of Lent, with its personal sacrifices and abstinence leading to Easter Sunday, 46 days later. Mardi Gras celebrations begin on the 12th night feast of the Epiphany, when the three kings visited the newborn Jesus Christ. In practice, Mardi Gras celebrates the excess of libidinous pleasure-seeking, of living for the moment, of wine, women, and song. Cares and obligations are forgotten, while celebrants indulge their sensual nature in communal revelries. It is a bacchanalian festivity that loosens behavior from its usual constraints and reason-based actions. However, there is always the preconscious awareness that this celebration is transitory, soon to be replaced by even greater than usual limits on personal pleasures and vices with the advent of Lent. The Mardi Gras effect involves temporarily giving up the traditional cognitive and moral constraints on personal behavior when part of a group of like-minded revelers bent on having fun now without concern for subsequent consequences and liabilities. It is de-individualization in group action. Dehumanization and moral disengagement. Dehumanization is the central construct in our understanding of man's inhumanity to man. Dehumanization occurs whenever some human beings consider other human beings to be excluded from the moral order of being a human person. The objects of this psychological process lose their human status in the eyes of their dehumanizers. By identifying certain individuals or groups as being outside the sphere of humanity, dehumanizing agents suspend the morality that might typically govern reasoned actions toward their fellows. Dehumanization is a central process in prejudice, racism, and discrimination. Dehumanization stigmatizes others, attributing to them a spoiled identity. For example, the sociologist Irving Goffman described the process by which those who are disabled are socially discredited. They become not fully human and thus tainted. Under such conditions, it becomes possible for normal, morally upright, and even usually idealistic people to perform acts of destructive cruelty. Not responding to the human qualities of other persons automatically facilitates inhumane actions. The golden rule then becomes truncated: do unto others as you would. It is easier to be callous or rude toward dehumanized objects, to ignore their demands and pleas, to use them for your own purposes, even to destroy them if they are irritating. A Japanese general reported that it had been easy for his soldiers to brutally massacre Chinese civilians during Japan's pre-World War II invasion of China, because we thought of them as things, not people like us. This was obviously so during the Rape of Nanking in 1937. Recall the description in Chapter 1 of the Tutsis by the woman who orchestrated many of the rapes of them. They were nothing more than insects, cockroaches. Similarly, the Nazi genocide of the Jews began by first creating, through propaganda films and posters, a national perception of these fellow human beings as inferior forms of animal life, as vermin, as voracious rats. The many lynchings of black people by mobs of whites in cities throughout the United States were likewise not considered crimes against humanity, because of the stigmatization of them as only niggers. Behind the My Lai massacre of hundreds of innocent Vietnamese civilians by American soldiers was the dehumanizing gooks label that GIs had for all of those different-looking Asian people. Yesterday's gooks have become today's Hajis and towel heads in the Iraq War, as a new corps of soldiers derogates these different-looking citizens and soldiers. You just sort of try to block out the fact that they're human beings and see them as enemies, said Sergeant Mejia, who refused to return to action in what he considered an abominable war. You call them Hajis, you know? You do all the things that make it easier to deal with killing them and mistreating them. That such labels and their associated images can have powerful motivating effects was demonstrated in a fascinating controlled laboratory experiment mentioned in Chapter 1, elaborated here. Experimental dehumanization, animalizing college students. My Stanford University colleague, Albert Bandura, and his students designed a powerful experiment that elegantly demonstrates the power of dehumanizing labels to foster harm against others. 72 male volunteers from nearby junior colleges were divided into three-member supervisory teams, whose task was to punish the inadequate decision-making of other college students who were allegedly serving as a group of decision-makers. The real subjects of the study were, of course, the students playing the role of supervisors. On each of 25 bargaining trials, the supervisors heard the decision-making team, reported to be in an adjacent room, supposedly formulating collective decisions. The supervisors were given information they used to evaluate the adequacy of the decision on each trial. Whenever a bad decision was made, it was the job of this supervisory team to punish the error by administering a shock. They could choose the shock intensity from a mild level of 1 to a maximum level of 10 on any trial, which all the members of the decision-making team would receive. The supervisors were told that participants from different social backgrounds were included in this project to increase its generality, but each group of decision-makers was composed of people with similar attributes. This was done so that the positive or negative labels soon to be applied to them would hold for the entire group. The researchers varied two features of this basic situation: how the victims were labeled and how personally responsible the supervisors were for the shocks they administered. The volunteers were randomly assigned to three conditions of labeling: dehumanized, humanized, or neutral, and two conditions of responsibility: individualized or diffused. Let's first consider how the labeling was imposed and its effects. Then we will see how the responsibility variations operated. After settling into the study, each group of participants believed they were overhearing an interchange over the intercom between the research assistant and the experimenter about the questionnaires the decision makers had allegedly completed. The assistant remarked in a brief aside that the personal qualities exhibited by this group confirmed the opinion of the person by whom they had been recruited. In the dehumanized condition, the decision makers were characterized as an animalistic rotten bunch. By contrast, in the humanized condition, they were characterized as a perceptive, understanding, and otherwise humanized group. No evaluative references were made about those in the third, neutral condition. It should be made clear that the participants never interacted with their shock victims, and therefore could not make such evaluations personally or evaluate their adequacy. The labels were second-hand attributions made about other young college men, supposedly also volunteers functioning in an assigned role in this situation. So did the labels have any effect on how these college students punished those they were allegedly supervising? There were, in fact, no actual others, only standardized tape feedback. Indeed, the labels stuck and had a big impact on the extent to which the students punished their supervisees. Those labeled in the dehumanizing way, as animals, were shocked most intensively, and their shock level increased linearly over 10 trials. It also climbed higher and higher over trials, up to an average of 7 out of the maximum of 10 for each group of participants. Those labeled nice were given the smallest amount of shock, while the unlabeled neutral group fell in the middle of these two extremes. Further, during the first trial, there was no difference at all between the three experimental treatments and the level of shock administered. They all administered the same low level of shock. Had the study ended then, the conclusion would have been that the labels made no difference. However, with each successive trial, as the errors of the decision makers allegedly multiplied, the shock levels of the three groups diverged. Those shocking the so-called animals shocked them more intensely over time, a result comparable to the escalating shock level of the de-individuated female college students in my earlier study. That rise in aggressive responding over time, with practice or with experience, illustrates a self-reinforcing effect. Perhaps the pleasure is not so much in inflicting pain as in the sense of power and control one feels in such a situation of dominance, giving others what they deserve to get. The researchers point to the disinhibiting power of labeling to divest other people of their human qualities. On the plus side in this study, that same arbitrary labeling also resulted in others being treated with greater respect if someone in authority had labeled them positively. Those perceived as nice were harmed the least. Thus, the power of humanization to counteract punitiveness is of equal theoretical and social significance as the phenomenon of dehumanization. There is an important message here about the power of words, labels, rhetoric, and stereotyped labeling to be used for good or evil. We need to refashion the childhood rhyme, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never harm me," to alter the last phrase to, "But bad names can kill me, and good ones can comfort me." Finally, what about the variations in responsibility for the level of shock that was being administered? Significantly higher levels of shock were given when participants believed that the shock level was an average response of their team, rather than when it was the direct level of each individual's personal decision. As we have seen before, diffusion of responsibility in any form it takes lowers the inhibition against harming others. As one might predict, the very highest levels of shock and anticipated harm were administered both when participants felt less personally responsible and when their victims were dehumanized. When Bandura's research team evaluated how the participants had justified their performance, they found that dehumanization promoted the use of self-absolving justifications, which in turn were associated with increasing punishment. These findings about how people disengage their usual self-sanctions against behaving in ways that are detrimental to others led Bandura to develop a conceptual model of moral disengagement.